Peace be upon you. God willing, today we're going to talk about the admission test. So this is a test that every believer will have to go through. And what it is, it's basically a way to test our claims. That when we say we believe in God, that we're devoted 100% to God, that we're going to eliminate any forms of idol worship, those claims have to be tested. And if we pass, we're basically admitted into God's kingdom. And if we fail, we either revert, maybe fall off the path, or we will have to experience it again until, God willing, we get it right. So this is best depicted in chapter 29, verses 2 through 4, where it reads, "Do the people think that they will be left to say we believe without being put to the test? We have tested those before them, for God must distinguish those who are truthful, and he must expose the liars. Do those who commit sins think that they can ever fool us? Wrong indeed is their judgment." In the header of these verses, it says the test is mandatory. So this is something that every believer will have to go through. It's kind of like, you know, when you apply for university or you apply for a fellowship, you know, there might be a test of some sort to make sure that you're qualified to be admitted. And similarly, that's what we're tested with in this life to make it into God's kingdom. In 47:31, it reads, "We will certainly put you to the test in order to distinguish those among you who strive and steadfastly persevere. We must expose your true qualities." God knows, obviously, who deserves to go to heaven, who deserves to go to hell. But this is to basically show us why we end up where we do. When we're tested to bring out our true convictions, there's the example. It says, when you squeeze an orange, what do you get out of it? You get orange juice. Why? It's because that's what the orange is made of. And when you squeeze the human being by putting adversity and hardship on them, what do you get out of it? Do you get basically, you know, helplessness and denial of God and, you know, bad language? Or do you get steadfastness and perseverance and further strengthening of one's faith? And we'll see, I mean, what ends up happening in the test is that, you know, Satan's going to make a claim on the believer. And he's going to say that this believer, this particular believer, it's just lip service. He doesn't truly believe in God. And he's going to ask permission from God to shake up that person's life. And God is going to grant Satan certain parameters by which he can go and mess with a believer's life to see what is truly inside that believer's heart. And this is depicted in chapter 7, verse 16. He said, "Since you have willed that I go astray," so this is Satan speaking, says, "Since you have willed that I go astray," which is actually a lie, says, "I will skulk for them on your straight path. I will come to them from before them and from behind them and from the right and from the left, and you will find that most of them are unappreciative." And again in 4:1:18 and 1 through 1:20 reads, "God has condemned him, Satan, and he said," so Satan said, "I will surely recruit a definite share of your worshippers. I will mislead them. I will entice them. I will command them to forbid the eating of certain meats by marking the ears of the livestock. And I will command them to distort the creation of God. Anyone who accepts the devil as the Lord instead of God has incurred a profound loss. He promises them and entices them. What the devil promises is no more than an illusion." So Satan's saying that, hey, I'm going to go and basically recruit a share of God's quote-unquote worshippers. And God is allowing Satan to do this. This is what God created Satan for, to test us, to purify us, to show why we end up going to heaven or to hell. And this is the mechanism that Satan does. And there's examples that we'll get to where how Satan tested the prophets through health, through wealth, through lack thereof, and basically also with their children. One thing to take in consideration is that every incident isn't necessarily a test. Some people think that, you know, something happens, they're late to class and they think this must be a test. And a test is something that's very exacting. It's meant to shake, you know, an individual up, to the point that they're asking, you know, they're questioning, their faith, they're questioning God's promise. It's to push us to our limit. And God knows where that limit is. And there's a verse in the Quran. Let's see if I can find it. It says 2:2:1:14 says, "Do you expect to enter paradise without being tested like those before you? They were tested with hardship and adversity and were shaken up until the messenger and those who believed with him said, 'Where's God's victory? God's victory is near.'" So the test is not to be taken lightly. This isn't like, oh, I lost my pencil, God must be testing us. This is something that, happens in your life while you're doing everything right, and it's basically because Satan has come in and tampered with it to see to bring out your true convictions. And there's a lot of things that happen in our life, and not every single one of them is a test. It might be a purification, it might be a blessing in disguise, an educational disaster, or you might have just flat out done something wrong, and in which case we would suffer the consequences for stepping out of God's kingdom. And in 2:155 and 3:186, it sheds a little more light about this test. In 2:155, it reads, "We will surely test you through some fear, hunger, loss of money, lives, crops. Give good news to the steadfast." In 3:186, the header is "The Inevitable Test." It says, "You will certainly be tested through your money and your lives, and you will hear from those who receive the scripture and from the idol worshippers a lot of insult. If you steadfastly persevere and lead a righteous life, this will prove the strength of your faith." And in the footnote, it reads, "After passing the admission tests," so keep in mind it's plural, "the proven worshipers of God alone enjoy a perfect life now and forever." So let's look at some of the things that were mentioned. So you're tested with fear, hunger, loss of money, lives, crops. Crops can be your business, right? Your food, your provisions. And you're going to receive insults, and this is going to be a test, right? People are going to mock you, they're going to ridicule you because you worship God alone, because you, do your contact prayer, you give your zakat, and this is going to be a sticking point with certain individuals. But if we're steadfast, this is the key, if God willing, we are steadfast and we persevere through our admission test, God promises us basically a perfect life. And the verses that are referred to is 10:62 through 64 reads, "Happiness now and forever." It says, "Absolutely, God's allies have nothing to fear, nor will they grieve. They're those who believe and lead a righteous life. For them, joy and happiness in this world as well as in the hereafter. This is God's unchangeable law. Such is the greatest triumph." So this is a law that's no different. It's as more concrete than the law of gravity, right? No one thinks that if they drop an object from a high place of a, I'd say, over a building, that it's going to fall towards the ground. Similarly, if we pass our admission test and we confirm, what's deep down inside our absolute devotion to God alone, then we are going to have a happy, perfect life now and forever. And again, 24:55, it reads, "God's promise, kings and queens on earth. God promises those among you who believe and lead a righteous life that he will make them sovereigns on earth as he did for those before them, and will establish for them the religion he has chosen for them, and will substitute peace and security for them in place of fear. All this because they worship me alone. They never set up any idols beside me. Those who disbelieve after this are truly wicked." So again, let's look at some of the things that God would allow Satan to test us on. In 64:15, it reads, "Your money and children are a test, and God possesses a great recompense." So at some point, most individuals are going to have children, and they're going to be tested with this. Satan's going to make a claim that, oh, they love their child more than they love God. And that claim has to be tested. Similarly with money, you're going to get to a point in your life, God willing, where we're going to be earning money, we're going to be feeling wealthy. And the question is, what happens when some of that money is lost temporarily, right? This is actually another critical point of the admission test is during the admission test, whatever you quote unquote lose will be restored to you. And it's nothing, you're not going to sustain like permanent damage during admission tests. This is something that in essence, Satan comes, messes up temporarily, gives you the illusion that, there is no hope. And in essence, when it's if we persevere, we're steadfast, we confirm that, hey, we truly believe in God under all conditions, it's going to be restored to us. In 21:35, it reads, "Every person will taste death after we put you to the test through adversity and prosperity. Then to us you ultimately return." So we're going to be tested with adversity and prosperity, right? Both ends of the spectrum. So at one point we're going to be tested because we're going to get a lot of wealth, accolades, just everything's going to be going great with us, and it's going to be seen, are we going to worship God unconditionally? Are we going to forget about God under these conditions? And then also on the other side of the spectrum, where we're going to face severe adversity, Something's going to happen in our lives. It's going to really shake us up. And we need to see, are we going to still be steadfast? Are we still going to trust in God? Is our faith going to be strengthened during these times? Or is it going to be diminished? Perfect example of this is in chapter 33. Let me jump to that really quick. We read this in the past, but it's at the time of war, where the disbelievers, you know, so these are people who said, okay, we're going to fight. But then the time came, and the response from the disbelievers is that, let's see if I can find this. Basically, the 33:12 says, the hypocrites and those with doubts in their hearts said, what God and his messenger promised us was no more than an illusion. A group of them said, O people of Yathrib, you cannot attain victory. Go back. Others made up excuses to the prophet. Our homes are vulnerable. They were not vulnerable. They just wanted to flee. So these are people that they came to the test. They were supposed to fight in battle, and they completely chicken out, and they bail. And then in retrospect, the believers, when they come to this situation, is the opposite. Let's see if I can find that. Says, when the true believers saw, so this is 33, verse 22, it says, when the true believers saw the parties ready to attack, they said, this is what God and his messenger have promised us, and God and his messenger are truthful. This dangerous situation only strengthened their faith and augmented their submission. So during the time of the admission test, it's critical that we try to draw closer to God, that we become more reverent, that we take our contact prayers that much more seriously, that we read the Quran that much more, because it's going to get to the point where Satan's going to try to get to us, and we need to draw closer to God so we can be successful. In 9:16, the header again is the inevitable test. It says, do you think that you will be left alone without God distinguishing those among you who strive and never ally themselves with God's enemies or the enemies of his messenger or the enemies of the believers? God is fully cognizant of everything you do. And in 9:24 it reads, proclaim, if your parents, your children, your siblings, your spouses, your family, the money you have earned, the business you worry about, and the homes you cherish are more beloved to you than God and his messenger and the striving in his cause, then just wait until God brings his judgment. God does not guide the wicked people. What's interesting about this is that every single one of us, we're going to be faced with that decision. Someone that we love is going to say it's either, you know, them or God. And we have to decide where do we stand, because it's inevitable, right? When we come to the message, we would be blessed if every single one of our loved ones embraced God's message and embraced God wholeheartedly. But inevitably, you're going to have people in our lives that are going to try to deter us from the message. And they're going to provide an ultimatum. They're going to say either, you know, God or me. And it's up to us to make sure that under these conditions that we absolutely, unequivocally side with God, that we never ally ourselves with, you know, anyone who's a quote-unquote enemy of God. So how do we make sure that we will be God-willing successful during the admission test? One is obviously do everything we can to grow our souls beforehand. Take the message to heart. In addition, there's some advice in 5175, 2456, and 1599. It reads, those who believe in God and hold fast to him, he will admit them into mercy from him in grace and will guide them to him in a straight path. So during the admission test, when we're shooken up, we need to just reach out and hold even tighter to God's rope, that God will protect us, will save us, will restore whatever it appears we lost for the time being. And as hard as it might seem, because you know, the devil's going to create this this disarray, this confusion, try to put doubt in our heart, we need to be steadfast. We need to hold tight to the rope of God. In 24:55, it says formula for success. So this is probably a good place to start. It says, you shall observe the contact prayer salat, give the obligatory charity zakat, and obey the messenger that you may attain mercy. So it's very critical that, you know, we're reverent during our contact prayers, that we do all five contact prayers, that we don't miss out on doing the obligatory charity on the day that we receive any income. And, you know, we try to be the absolute best submitter, not that, we, you know, at any time we wouldn't, but especially during these tests. And in 1599 it says, and worship your Lord in order to attain certainty. So if we have absolute certainty, doesn't matter what happens in our life, we are going to be completely steadfast and committed 100% to God. And God gives us examples of people who, in essence, when faced with adversity, they fall out, they drop out. And a good example of that is in 29, 10, and 11, it reads, "Fair weather friends, among the people there are those who say, 'We believe in God,' but as soon as they suffer any hardship because of God, they equate the people's persecution with God's retribution. But if blessings from your Lord come your way, they say, 'We were with you.' Is God not fully aware of the people's innermost thoughts? God will most certainly distinguish those who believe, and he will most certainly expose the hypocrites." So what ends up happening, from my understanding from this verse, is that, you know, these individuals, they claim they believe. They say, "We believe in God." And what inevitably happened is that they suffered hardship because of their belief in God, right? Some people insulted them, gave them a hard time, God knows what. And as opposed to being steadfast, they actually equated the persecution they were facing with God's retribution, and they reverted. We have to use our logic and reason and understanding. And when things happen in our life that we don't understand, we don't know why it's going on, first we reflect. We ask ourselves, we evaluate ourselves, we ask ourselves, are we committing any sins knowingly? Is there anything we might be overlooking? But throughout this entire process, we're going to have to be absolutely 100% devoted to God alone, that we don't get shooken up, that we don't think that, maybe I should stop doing my contact prayers, maybe I should stop worshiping God, maybe I should implore, you know, some idol beside God, because that's what Satan wants from us. That's what Satan is trying to get out of us, that he's going to try to shake us up and, in essence, make us slip, make us think that there's someone else beside God who can help us during these situations. And it's very important that during these admission tests, during these trials, these tribulations, that we, you know, are 100% absolutely devoted to God alone. Additional verses is in 22:11. It says, "Among the people there are those who worship God conditionally. If things go his way, he is content. But if some adversity befalls him, he makes an about face. Thus he loses both this life and the hereafter. Such is the real loss." Right? So these are people that if things go out, you know, according to the way they want, they're happy. The second that something happens that isn't per their plan, they renounce God, they revert, they stop doing their contact prayers, they question God's authority, all these bad stuff. And in essence, during that time, it shows that they're not a true believer, that this was just merely lip service to try to trick, you know, themselves, trick God into his kingdom. And, you know, God's going to bring out our true convictions. That's what happens in this life. Another thing to take in consideration is that, this kind of touches on the earlier point, is that God's tests are never unreasonable. So when God asks us to do something, or when God allows Satan to, you know, tamper with our lives for that time period, that it's never going to be unreasonable. And in 4:66, it reads, "Had we decreed for them, 'You must offer your lives or give up your homes,' they would not have done it, except for a few of them. Even if such a command was issued, had they done what they were commanded to do, it would have been better for them and would prove the strength of their faith." What I take away from this verse is that, you know, again, God's tests, as it says in the header, are never unreasonable. God is not going to ask us to do something like, "Hey, give away all your money, all your wealth, you know, disown your family and completely and go isolate yourself in some mountain somewhere." God's tests aren't going to be unreasonable. God is going to basically expect from us, and he knows how much we can handle, and the tests are going to be commensurate with the degree of faith that we have. In addition, in 4:147 says, "What will God gain from punishing you if you became appreciative and believed?" God is appreciative, omniscient. You know, God, there is no, God doesn't gain anything from just arbitrarily allowing us to go through hardship, adversity. These all happen for specific reasons. And if we trust in God, God may show us the reasons behind it. But either way, if he does or doesn't, we have to understand that this is for the best, that God has our best intentions in mind and is allowing this to happen to allow us to grow from it, to develop, to become better submitters. And let's look at some of the examples of the messengers as far as what tests they had to go through. So we saw in chapter 33 in regards to Muhammad that, you know, him and his followers at the time, they were tested with war. They had to go pick up arms and go to battle. And this clearly was something that I can expect that a lot of people might have felt uncomfortable with. But this was what was required for them. And in addition, in 4720 reads, those who believe said, "We will." Said, when will a new surah be revealed? When a straightforward surah was revealed, wherein fighting was mentioned, you would see those who harbored doubts in their hearts looking as at you as if death had already come to them. They were thus exposed, right? So these people, in essence, it's like, look, this is what was expected from them. It was an exacting trial, and those who fulfilled it were either rewarded with martyrdom or, in essence, sainthood. And in essence, these people who didn't, they showed that, hey, they were flimsy believers, right? They weren't true believers, and they dropped out. They weren't admitted. And in essence, it's interesting is we're only required, in essence, to make that step forward. God is the one who does everything else, right? When it comes to adversity during the admission test, it's not us who fixes the situation. God is the one who basically relieves the adversity, relieves the hardship, and gives us that peaceful contentment. It's just our duty to that when these incidents happen, to be steadfast, to persevere, to not have ill thoughts about God and God's promise. Another example is in Abraham. This is the satanic dream that Abraham had, where he thought that God wanted him to kill his son. And it reads in 37:1-2-1-6, it says, when he grew enough to work with him, he said, my son, I see in a dream that I am sacrificing you. What do you think? He said, oh, my father, do what you were commanded to do. You'll find me, God willing, patient. They both submitted, and he put his forehead down to sacrifice him. God intervened, save Abraham and Ishmael. We called him, O Abraham, you have believed the dream. We thus reward the righteous. That was an exacting test indeed. So what happened in this incident is that Satan made a claim against Abraham and said, hey, Abraham loves his son too much, and watch, if I give him this commandment that I make him think is coming from God, that he won't fulfill it. And what's just absolutely like amazing is the level of devotion that Abraham had, that he had this thought that, hey, this was a dream that God wanted him to sacrifice Ishmael, and he was willing to carry it out, even though this dream was not from God, and it was actually Satan trying to dupe Abraham. He was still willing to basically to follow through, and it just shows the degree of faith and devotion that Abraham had. Note that, you know, God never advocates vice. God would never, in essence, command someone to kill an innocent person. This is something that came from Satan, and it was a test to test Abraham, and the intention was never to harm Ishmael. In footnote of chapter 38, verse 34 and 41, it reads, Solomon and Job represented both ends of the testing spectrum. We are put to the test through wealth, health, and lack of them, to see if we worship God alone under all circumstances. And in the example of Solomon, it's in chapter 38, verse 30 through 40, it reads, to David we granted Solomon, a good and obedient servant. One day he became preoccupied with beautiful horses until the night fell. He then said, I enjoyed the material things more than I enjoyed worshiping my Lord until the sun was gone. And in the footnote, it reads that Solomon missed his afternoon prayer because of his horses. So he was, he got preoccupied. To nullify Satan's possible claim that Solomon loved his horses more than loving God, he got rid of his horses. Look at that level of commitment. He thought that, hey, Satan's going to make a claim on me because I was preoccupied with my horses rather than doing my salat, my contact prayer. So to avoid Satan's claim, he just got rid of his horses. So in 33, it continues, says, bring them back to bid farewell. He rubbed their legs and necks. We thus put Solomon to the test. We blessed him with vast material wealth, but he steadfastly submitted. He said, my Lord, forgive me and grant me a kingship never attained by anyone else. You are the grantor. We answered his prayer and committed the wind at his disposal, pouring rain wherever he wanted. And when the devils building and diving, others were placed at his disposal. This our provision to you. You may give generously or withhold without limits. He has deserved an honorable position with us. and a wonderful abode. So, you know, God granted Solomon this this mass kingship to the point that he had the winds, the waves at his disposal. He had jinns working for him, you know, diving and building structures for him and whatever it is that he asked for. And this was to show that, you know, would he worship God with all this distraction, with all this wealth? And we see in these verses that, yeah, you know, God presented this all to him, and he still was steadfast to the point that even if he got distracted with something and missed the contact prayer, that he would just get rid of it. And then in the other side of the spectrum, we have the example of Job. And if you get the chance to read the book of Job in the Bible, you can see this is exactly what happens, is that Satan made a claim on Job and said, hey, if God allowed him to mess with Job's life, that Job would become unappreciative and denounce God. And in 38:41, it reads, the devil afflicts Job. It says, remember our servant Job, he called upon his Lord. The devil has afflicted me with hardship and pain. God responds, strike the ground with your foot. A spring will give you healing and a drink. And, you know, Job went through a lot of hardship, and God made it up to him. And we see in the following verses that not only did God make it up to the believers, but if we pass our admission test, it says God makes it up to the believers actually twice. We get double the reward. And in 38:43, it reads, we restored his family for him. So keep in mind that the word is restored. This is the same word that Moses' mother was used towards Moses' mother when she was reunited with Moses. So unlike the Bible, in the Quran, we don't see this concept of, you know, Job physically losing his family to death. Something happened that he wasn't able to contact them, and God restored his family to him. And it says twice as many, meaning that God expanded Job's progeny. And it continues, says, such is our mercy, a reminder for those who possess intelligence. Now you shall travel the land and preach the message to fulfill your pledge. We found him steadfast. What a good servant. He was a submitter. And this is where it gets really interesting, in my opinion. It cites, remember also our servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were resourceful and possessed vision. And we see that this example, again, like Abraham, he went through the admission test with Ishmael, and God gave him not only Ishmael, but then in addition, Isaac and Jacob, who were also prophets. Jacob was Isaac's son, and Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael was the oldest, and then it was Isaac. And so you see that, you know, Abraham got double the reward. In 38:46, it continues, and we bestowed upon them a great blessing, awareness of the hereafter. They were chosen, for they were among the most righteous. And it says, remember Ishmael, Elijah, and Zelkiphel among the righteous. Now, what's really cool about this is Ishmael, according to the Bible, received double the portion of inheritance in Deuteronomy verse 21, verse 17. So, you know, Ishmael in the Bible received double the portion. So kind of with that theme of God making up to the believers, restoring them twice as many. And then Elijah in the Bible in 2 Kings 2:9, it reads, when they crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, so this is Elijah said to Elisha, tell me what can I do for you before I'm taken from you. And Elijah's response was, let me inherit a double portion of your spirit. So this was given to Elisha by Elijah. I know those two names might sound very similar. One is E-L-I-S-H-A, the other one is E-L-I-J-A-H. And if you want to look at it, it's in 2 Kings in the Bible, chapter 2, verse 9. So again, you see, you know, Ishmael had double the inheritance, Elijah had double the spirit, and Zalkiphel literally translates to double the possessor of double portion. So it's pretty awesome, you know, that God in the Quran selected these examples when talking about restoring Job's family and providing him with twice as many. That my takeaway is that when we go through admission tests, whatever we lost, God is going to make it up to us double. And in 1780 through 81, we're going to stop here, but it's a powerful prayer, and it's something that, you know, when we're going through the admission test, or, you know, I do it personally before Going to sleep, when I wake up, I say, "My Lord, admit me an honorable admittance. Let me depart an honorable departure. Grant me from you a powerful support. The truth has prevailed and the falsehood has vanished. Falsehood will inevitably vanish." So, God, please admit all the believers into your paradise, into the gardens of bliss. Allow us to be steadfast. Allow us to grow our souls. And God willing, when we do go through the admission test, allow us to be successful and fly through it and wholeheartedly to God's rope. Until next time, peace and God bless.